The following program may contain content that your kids would love to hear, but you may not want them to.
Okay, here we go.
Listening to Frank Capello.
Okay, here we go.
Listening to Frank Capello.
Nine-year-old milkman up the street here. Did you ever think of your future, or did you think you had a future?
Well, I don't think at nine one thinks in terms of your future, to be honest. 1939, one was talking then about the main topics was the war. Mm-hmm. And no matter how privileged or underprivileged or whatever your circumstances are or where, somehow until you move on or move out or do some things different, as you don't have anything to compare it with, you just think it's absolutely normal.
And you think were you happy then at your best memory or teenage years, early teenage?
No, not madly. I mean, that side of the work side I liked with it, because mm-hmm. I then got introduced to the horses and that kind of mm-hmm. thing. And it was one realizes in retrospect how different it must be for, like, same age kids now. None of the men, the young men anyway, were around. They were all in the services.
That's right.
And the older guys were in munitions or, you know, training for the Home Guard or something. And 14-year-olds, like I became at the time, and this friend of mine, Danny Fraser, we had horses and were delivering milk, doing the men's jobs.
Mm. You know, a lot of teenagers, I'm thinking about them today because they're in the news so much lately. You have so much self-confidence that I'm sure you've gotten over the years of being successful. What point did it kick in for you? Did you start feeling pretty good about yourself and confident?
Well, I mean, I got into the Navy and I was signed for 12 years, and I was out after three with ulcers. Mm-hmm. And so one certainly wasn't full of confidence. Mm-hmm. And also, academically, one was zilch. And so one kind of had to educate completely. And it was and at the same time, one went to bodybuilding. So I think one got a kind of combination of an education and something to do with the physical side as well. And
started feeling good about yourself.
Yeah.
And then you were a nude model. You better feel good about yourself.
Yeah, that's true.
You are keeping this strictly business, right, Matt?
Strictly.
Okay, here we go. Are you still having a good time doing movies?
Listening
yeah.
to Frank Capello.
As long as you don't do too many in a row, is that what it is?
Well, in the middle of this one, very, very arduous, heavy schedule, and the two hats were making it difficult to do.
We interrupt this program for no reason. Had there been a reason, you'd have been asked to go along with it and perhaps even take off your pants. But there is no reason, so now we return you to the program.
Now, I want to talk to you because you're obviously upset.
Permission is granted.
Glad I met you. I'm glad I met you, James.
I was not considering the fact that I, in fact, am the third man, capital T, capital D, capital M. But I am.
I want to show you something.
Let's take off all our clothes.
And maybe that's true. And that's what I said.
That's how we used to sing it. I'm sorry. That's just the way we used to sing it. It's the way you should sing it from now on.
But look at this. What is this?
I hate to put a negative spin on this, because it's great to drink, and everyone loves to drink.
They say you should not drink alcohol when it's so hot.
And I've talked about this, too, in the past, when I talked about soccer moms.
That was so good.
No, I didn't talk about soccer moms.
Excuse Excuse me for saying it. It's not even my place to say it.
I'll talk about soccer moms who became roller derby moms. And don't...
It was the old stuff.
And don't you think I haven't stopped. I have given up on the roller derby thing. Let's just get Pi Kim on the phone.
Wait. Where are the phones? They took the phones.
Huh? They're not using Skype. Tonight, today, this afternoon.
You're such a hero. You're so rich. How come you're coming down here and waste your time with such a bunch of bums?
But let's not get into that. Let's not talk about me. Even though it is all about me. Let's not talk about me. Let's talk about Nancy.
What did I learn as a kid on Western? You don't sell a guy one car.
But I believe that, you know, we could have a lot more fun. I'm not trying to be politically correct here either.
So I don't know, do I? Let me have your attention for a moment.
Do what you got to do if you're a neo-postmodernist, and I know you are.
What is that?
Look, just go, Jay, the best thing to do is to just Google the gal.
Let's talk about something important.
I really am when it comes to this thing.
Let's talk about something important.
Just a whole nother angle just took place in my head.
Put that coffee down.
But let's forget about drugs and medicine. Let's talk about sex.
Have you made your decision for Christ?
That's going to be happening. I got some things to cover before we get there. Dirty Things Get Stiff by Frank Cotola.
It may mean something to you. It may not. I don't know. I don't know anymore.
Does that mean that if you dirty things stand, dirty things get stiff?
Vaguely remember that happening sometime.
That's Scatola over there. You know what I mean?
Something resembling a normal life. I don't know. Broadcasting now turns on the mic and prepares to chronicle Postmodernists, you sunburnt sicklemen of April weary, come hither from the furrow and be merry. You think it's late? It's later than you think. Wake up, it's night! Philosophical entertainment, relevant irreverence, netterati, couple surface, netaholics, and infomaniacs. Here we go again. Are you curious, Yellow? Because it's time to stake your claim. As me, Frank Atolo, man's name, but don't title of the show, takes you through Y2K plus 13 of the April. Da-da-da-da-da.
ice cap to ice cap, from Hamlet to City, from Othello, and into every bordello, one by one. I wonder if it's every room. Yes, it's pumped in, piped in, I should say. I can use the word pump. It's piped into every single room in all the bordellos. Our first audience, those people who were so outrageously physical. My name is Frank Atolo, and the man whose name adorns the title of the show. In the opening collage was a very brief interview with a man we all know from one movie or another. Maybe we don't. Is it possible that people out there don't know Sean Connery? I don't know. I have not. I don't know where you. Even someone living as isolated a life as I, and it's really not, in essence, you know, being connected, because I'm well connected to the social networking world, to the internet, to this show, and all the people that I deal with. Even if I don't actually wear a tie for them in person, I do see them. I am connected, but I think everyone knows Sean Connery, whose real name, by the way, is Rudy Mankiewicz. No, I'm joking about that. It's not Rudy Mankiewicz. I'm not here to shed any rumors or what have you. I'm here to bring up something that happened to come to my attention this week. And I don't know why it turned out to be Sean Connery. Perhaps I don't remember seeing a movie or something. I don't know what happened. But for some reason or another, I said to myself during one of my pensive moments, while the sun was shining, the grass beginning to grow this springtime, and whatever else happens out here in the middle of frickin' nowhere. I think if you read my... Frank Atolo, middle of frickin' nowhere, USA. It'll somehow get here. But it dawned on me that my life... I think I know how this happened. This happened because two reasons. Number one, I was settling affairs. I'm doing things, paper, bills, stuff, you know, the kind of stuff that you just have to do if you don't have a staff to do it. And budgeting and doing all this stuff that I do to keep my little boat afloat. And suddenly I realized, as I often do, that I am, in essence, in the same situation as people who are not doing those things, people who, like, for instance, and I don't know why he came to mind, Sean Connery, who has retired. Now, he's retired from acting and personal appearances. So wherever Sean Connery spends his time now, you know, it's not in the public eye. He's very private, and he's out in the middle of nowhere in Scotland. In the middle of frickin' nowhere. He's getting my mail, in fact. People are sending Frank Atolo's mail to Sean Connery, middle of frickin' nowhere. And he's not in the USA, though. He's probably in Scotland or Ireland or somewhere there. Scotland, where he was born. He's not Irish, he's Scottish. It dawns on me that regardless of his wealth and fame and the fact that he doesn't have to sit down, and maybe he does, maybe Sean Connery sits down and writes out checks and has a day of administrative bliss and by his desk, by a big wooden desk, as I do. I have a lot in common with Sean Connery now. Although I am not retired, I am in a sense retired. And that is that my career, whatever that might have ever been, the millions of things it might have been, is over. I just sit, stand, do exercises, cook. I do things in my house, and I do things with my... And my children are rapidly growing. I'm a widower. What I mean is, I'm alone. I guess all men who are married are widowers. My new book, it'll be out next week. All men who were married are widowers. And Sean, although he probably has, I think he has a woman hanging around. I don't know if he's remarried. Well, one of his wives died a year or so ago, his first, I don't know. But the thing is that, you know, what is Sean Connery doing? Maybe he's writing. I'm writing. And maybe he's hanging around once in a while. He golfs. I know he plays golf. Okay, he plays golf. I do all my horse racing stuff. And I do my lawn. I don't have Mexicans, Cubans, or any other kind of Spaniards doing my lawns. I do myself. I do them myself. I do them myself. I do all this stuff in an isolated area, not in the public eye, other than this, and you are the public, and that, of course, goes on this show, goes on everywhere, you know, all over the world, but so are the, so, in that essence, even, it's on, you know, it, Sean Connery's movies are constantly playing, so you could go see him, just like you could go, listen to me. When I am doing this, it is a performance per se, but I'm nowhere. I'm in the middle of frickin' nowhere. So there's that. Now, Sean Connery may have an awful lot more money than me. May have? Hello? Hello? He doesn't need Kickstarter. But by the same token, I have what I need. I don't need to have a Rolls Royce. So there's no reason for me to sit back and work hard or save up to get an expensive car. I just need one that runs. And that, so my needs are far between and few. So in essence, I have a wealth that can be counted. It can be, you can figure it. And of course, let's look at the age. In a sense, Sean is older than I. But in a sense, I am on that side of life. I'm on Sean's side of life. And so there stands I, and I picked Sean because he is retired, see, and that means no more endeavors. And I don't really have any endeavors. I do what I do, and there's a lot of residue, performances and stuff. But I don't do anything to necessarily keeps me, keeps generating the vision. There's no more vision. I don't have a vision. There's no more. There's no, you know, there's no path. This is the Hallelujah Trail I'm on. You're on it too. Only it's probably a lot longer trail for you. So now in that particular comparison is a very peaceful, settling understanding of life. And it's something that, it's good. For me, I don't know what's good for you. You find what's good for you. I'm not responsible. It's good for me, and it's freeing, but it is ever so continually isolating. And I believe that's the same thing with Sean. He's probably got a few friends here and there and what have you, but I mean, there's like this, it's a matter of isolation going on there. And I don't think, that he's picking up new friends. You know, he's not going out there. I need some new friends. I got, you know, it's just not. So in essence, and plus, of course, I believe we must have similar interests. He's ethnic in a Scottish way, and I'm ethnic in an Italian way, although I'm not necessarily, I don't embrace this. Friend of mine used to say, an old mentor of mine, not just a friend, used to say, never put down your blood, your legacy, your blood. Your inheritance. It's not inheritance either. You know, your blood work. Don't screw up with your blood work, is what he said. So, I do my own blood work. I go to the doctor, I say, here, take out a vial, I'll go home, I'll use my little chemistry set, and that's what happens. But, so the point is, if you sit, whatever you're doing, match it up with someone you admire or somebody you follow or someone you like in an industry that you have nothing to do with. You don't know this person, okay? You just have an image of this person. Match up your life wherever you might be at the moment with that. And you're going to, and there's some, and you're like, well, you have a lot more in common with these people who are so-called the super mega successes. Maybe the success that we're talking about here is survival and you know, doing what it is you like to do and you manage to survive. Maybe that's the big success. It doesn't matter if there's $200,000 more dollars in one bank account or not. Of course it matters. I'm sorry. I didn't mean that. Of course it matters. But you know what I'm saying? And when I say you know what I'm saying, you never can say yes. And I can hear you. You can nod your head, but I can't. But you know what it is. So every once in a while, I used to be a resident here. Yeah. And one of the rare things. I also like to speak every once in a while like Sean Connery, or like I think he sounds. I use all that, you know. I take myself. What are you prepared to do? What are you prepared? Remember that? And the Untouchables. What are you prepared to do? That's when he was dying. What are you prepared to do? I don't sit around though and think of imitation. I don't. But anyway, so there's my little thing there about where I am at this particular time in my life. I will hopefully live as long and even longer. I'm like, I guess, how can you hope you live longer? That's really mean. That's stupid. But then again, I've been known to be stupid. My name is Frank Atolo. I'm the man whose name adorns the title of this show. And boy, speaking of me being stupid, by contrast to the guest we have on this show, who we haven't had here in since 2013 began, Dr. Andrew Woldahr. And we're going to talk about science and space. And we're going to talk about, and you are going by, you want to talk about contrasts? Okay, I might be a lot like Sean Connery in many different ways. I am nothing like Dr. Andrew Woldahr. That is my loss, and believe me, because the smarts that go on in his head are just incredible. We're going to talk about space, which I, you know, a lot of people have said to me all my life that I take up too much space. Remember that old joke when I was a kid? Uncles used to go, hey, yeah, when are you going to school? What are you taking up? Space? Yeah. The same jokes over and over again, these uncles. What is it with uncles? You know? It's like there's just more annoying uncles than there were any uncles. Did you have a great uncle? I wish I had Uncle Sean. I wish Sean was my uncle. Imagine if Sean Connery is my uncle. Shay, are you coming over this weekend? And Frankie. He would call me Frankie. He wouldn't call me Frank. Sean would call me Frank. You know, and the other thing is that my voice is so damn high for my age. You know? There's so much going on with me that doesn't say, put him away, you know? And yet there's so many people who say, put him away. I've had it with him. I'm sick of him. He ruins me. But there's those thousands of people who listen to Cthulhu Chronicles, and you are one of them, or two of them, or three of them. I don't know how many are in the room with you, but I'm here. And Dr. Woldahr is going to be here momentarily through the brilliant, sophisticated technology of Skype, S-K-Y-P-E. And we haven't had Dr. Woldahr. He's been so busy, always doing things. We're going to talk about planets. We're going to talk about space, time, little things like atoms and subatoms. The end of the world, beginning of the world, the big boom, the big bang, and all that stuff. And he's going to tell us some things that are like garbage. Because, you know, you read these, you know, on the internet, right? You read things and everybody goes, "Did you? I read this on the internet. It's garbage." But we're not going to talk about Sean. Not going to talk about Sean. I was going to play and I probably should have, because that interview wasn't the greatest of all time. But you know me, I'm never rehearsed, but I'm always prepared. I just shoved that thing in there. I was going to play Sean reciting a Beatles song, which probably would have been even better. Except I don't even know. I couldn't verify it was real because so many people are out there talking like that. Isn't that amazing? And he's retired, and they still talk. Nobody's out there talking like Frank Cotolo. You could bet your bottom dollar. And I don't know, the bottom dollar means last dollar, by the way. That's what that phrase means. You can bet your last dollar, your bottom dollar. So the one on the bottom of the pile, the last one. You can bet your last dollar. Nobody is out there doing that. And nobody's going to get up. You go to like a lounge in a casino or where they have entertainment, or you go to Vegas or go to some theater, and guy's going to get up and he's going to do imitations. He's not going to go, okay, now I want to do Frank Cotolo. Not going to happen. That doesn't necessarily flatter me. But I am not here to be flattered. I'm here to guide you through information, conversation, and insubordination in this new millennium. Luck, smarts, guts, and hearts. I'm here to sell you books, too, but I don't have the book commercial queued up. That's the word, queued up. I want to say this while we're shortly going to get to Dr. Woldahr here. Next week, another Savino Cotolo Chronicles. And I want you to get your oxygen masks ready, because we're going to talk about some stuff I know is just going to crack us up. It's going to be a lot of laughing, a lot of jokes. You're going to have to write it all down or listen to it again on the many, many stations that play this show. I've had a number of other inquiries about stations wanting to play the show. And believe it or not, some guys who don't even know, they run stations. They don't even know. They've never even heard of the show. You do a show. Think about this. You do a show for 15, 20 years, and nobody knows about it. I'm not nobody. I mean, there's still people don't know what you're doing. And these people are supposed to be in the know of what's happening with internet radio, and yet they don't know about the first original. The first original? There was a second original? The original talk show on the internet. They don't know. Why? Stupid. They're stupid. Now they're not going to want me on this show. And they're going to go, see, Frank, you did it again. But what would Uncle Sean say? You know, I'm going to use this from now on. It's Uncle Sean. I'm going to make this character up in my head. Okay, and I'll talk to him during the day, and I'll talk to him on the radio here, at least for as long as I remember it. Because you know me, these things, like, they just come and go. And I'll talk to Uncle Sean. What would you say about that? They're stupid. I think they're all stupid. What are they prepared to do? Right? Play the show or not? We're working on a new Molotov memoirs, like you care. You should. They should. It's terribly funny. It's a terribly funny book. What are you prepared to read? Okay, now I'm getting carried away. I'm allowed to be carried away. Many people would like me to be carried away. My name is Frank Cotolo, and the man whose name adorns the title of this show is Cotolo Chronicles. And through the courtesy of Skype and the fact that my wireless is working right now, I'm going to move this over and look for him. I'm looking for him, Dr. Andrew Woldar, now on Cotolo Chronicles exclusively. You know, you can't turn on the Rush Bulbous Head Show, or the other, you know, Glenn Barecki Deck Dick Show, and listen to Andrew Woldar. You can't do it, because those guys be going to the least. And I'm not. You know what? Here's the deal. Okay, and this is the God's honest truth. I'm not playing to the least common denominator. Nobody who is the least common denominator, the bottom dollar people, do not listen. This is a special audience. It's always been a special audience. And that's why there's not 200,000 of them. Think about this. If Genghis Khan needed an army and he wanted every soldier to be special, he'd have 10 soldiers. He never would have been able to populate the world that way. You need hundreds of thousands. Look at Hannibal. He had all the elephants, but he had to have more than that. He had to have guys. So if you demand too much, you're not going to have a lot. Special people attend the special ceremonies that are these programs, that are shows, not programs. And then the others, bingo. Okay, so I'm not. So you can't listen to the Gleck Becks and the Blick Blocks and the Bill. I want to say this right now. I want to say this. I hate. Hate is a good. Don't use the word hate. Don't use the word hate, okay? And anytime he wants to come on this show, he can. His name is Bill Cunningham. Okay, here's what. Frank hates Bill Cunningham as a broadcaster, as a man who talks on the radio. I hate his face. I hate the way his smile moves. I'm being totally honest with you now. Okay, so that's it. And I'm not talking to the least common denominator. I know I'm not a great American, Bill. And if you're here, if you walk in this room right now, I'll punch you in the face. Now that I've gotten that out of my system here, let's call Dr. Andrew Woldar, a man who I embrace.
I'm not talking to the least.
Looks
like
I'll
have to cut the other feed.
Yeah, he's listening to me. Isn't that great? When a guy's going to be, or a gal is going to be a guest, and they're actually listening to the show.
All right, one second here.
Okay, it's Dr. Woldar.
Yeah, the last that I heard was a rant on Bill Cunningham, and then the phone rang.
Yeah, you know, we don't play to the least common denominator here, and I really despise a lot of these guys, not because they're, you know, necessarily successful, they got more money in their pockets, but just because they're just so I can see right through them. I don't think I'm so see-throughable.
No.
Yeah.
No, you're opaque.
But those guys, man, I mean, and that guy really bugs living daylights out of me. I just wanted to invite him to the show.
Yeah, let me know how that works out.
Dr. Andrew Woldar, if you've been listening over the years, has comes to us from his home in Saskatchewan. Or I don't know where. I guess he wishes he lived in Saskatchewan. It's a place that, you know, I can hardly spell. But he's a wonderful guy. And as I was saying at the beginning of the show, if you want to contrast stupid to intelligent, this is your time. That's what, and I think that's why we work so well together when he's on the show. Right? Because if I was like two guys who are incredibly smart speaking together, is like, I mean, it's like Sleep City.
I don't know, Frank.
Okay. All right. I'm not going to put you on the spot. You're here because, and it's been so long since you've been here. How are you feeling? Are you feeling all right?
Yeah, I'm feeling better. I the ridiculopathy is under control. I'm able to write on the blackboard.
There's something else I can't spell. The indicolocopy.
It's really, things are feeling pretty good.
Good.
And, you know, writing on the board is very important for my profession.
You do a lot. You do a lot of writing with chalk and.
Oh yeah, yeah. While teaching or while doing research, so yeah, I'm happy to say that right now, knock on wood, you know, right now things are good.
Well, that's fine, and I know that because I've been trying to every week. I'm telling them, look, pop a couple of pain pills and come on. But Dr. Woldar's not like that. He says, I got to be ready. I got to feel well in order to be there and have a clear mind. I appreciate that because God knows if I did that, I'd be on once every 3 years. So in the world of science and math and what have you, I'm just going to bring up one thing, and you probably saw it already, but you're going to tell us some other things. I know you've prepared some stuff, but I want to talk later on about what I read in the Washington Post today about two planets that seem perfect for life. Did you read about that?
Yeah, I came across that. There's this honor society to which I belong, which is Sigma Xi. And it's really wonderful because they send me something along the line of about 120 stories a month.
Wow. Oh, a month. Okay.
Yeah. And I parse through them. And I did come across some stories about these planets that may where life may be, a possibility. It may be inhabitable.
But you had some other things ahead of that.
I did.
So why don't we start doing that? I'm only going to take at 10 o'clock, if you have to run to the bathroom, fine, but whatever. But we're not going to take any major stuff. We're going to talk all the way through. We'll just do a little break in ID, and we'll move on. So let's take our time. Let's get as intricate as we want to be, and we'll hand it over right now to the doctor. You don't have to write on the board there. You don't have to write.
I do not.
Okay. Yep. I'll interject.
Okay. Well, the first thing I wanted to talk about, you were talking earlier about some of the garbage on the internet. And the first thing is an article, and there's been a lot of articles to this effect. The particular one I refer to is scientists examine nothing and find something. And I'd like to rename that scientists examine something and find nothing, because that's really much more accurate. And what they're doing, it turns out that a team of experimenters, the experimental physicists from France, they claim to have measured different speeds of light in a vacuum. And this, of course, would stand in, you know.
Did they do that while they were cleaning the parlor? How do you look into a vacuum? How do you do that?
Well, okay, so what they're talking about, obviously, right, is a vacuum, meaning some chamber that's absent of matter, of physical matter.
Well, what do you do? Do we have those things like around the house and we don't know it, or what? What do they look into?
Oh, not normally.
Do you buy them on eBay or what?
Okay, Frank, focus. The first thing is that in these vacuums, what they're trying to do is they're trying to simulate deep space, because that's the closest place to having a natural vacuum. But what happens is that what they're challenging, you see, is Einstein's grand assumption, which is that speed of light is constant. And they're saying in the article it could be incorrect and so on and so forth. And here I call foul. In fact, the way I see it, it's a flawed experiment, and that's what I want to discuss. So that's like the first thing that You have to understand that the speed of light is one of the five universal constants in physics.
Well, I want to understand these things, and remember, interrupting you, I'm trying to dumb down some of this stuff because I'm an idiot. So, you know, you tell me, okay, Frank, what are the five constants? You know, and what am I going to say? I'm going to say, I mean, at one time I thought Johnny Carson was one of the five, but I was wrong.
No, they are the speed of light, gravitational constant, the reduced Planck constant.
Which? What's that? What was that third one?
Reduced Planck. Reduced Planck constant.
The reduced Planck
constant.
Constant. The
reduced. Yeah, which is very, very important.
Sure.
In mechanics.
Yeah. And third?
That was third.
Oh, fourth? I can't even count.
Fourth, the Coulomb constant, and the Boltzmann constant. And these are, you know, they're all involved very heavily in the theory of relativity. And like, for example, speed of light is kind of the cornerstone. The fact that the speed of light is constant is a cornerstone of special relativity. And what you see here, actually, there's quite a division between experimental physicists and theoretical physicists that basically stems from the fact that if you go back 100 years and further, what happens is the roles were more or less equal. But since that time, the role of the experimental physicist has been greatly diminished. And that's mainly because the types of things that are being looked at nowadays, you can't really conduct controlled experiments for them. So what happens, there's quite a bit of jealousy, is what I believe. In fact, speaking in terms of academic scholarship, there's really much less of a difference between a mathematician and a theoretical physicist than there is between a theoretical physicist and experimental physicist. So what happens is experimental physicists tend to try and conduct experiments where they can just undermine results of theoretical physicists. And the media jumps on it and says, oh, you know, Einstein was a fool, you know, that kind of stuff. So what I want to get into is this one here where they are talking about light traveling in a vacuum, which, as I say, simulates deep space. It's they measure a vacuum by having a minimum amount of gas pressure. It's supposed to be completely void of all matter. And that's part of the problem, as you'll see in a second, or maybe not a second, but a minute. So the first thing I want to talk about is the speed of light itself, because there are two prevailing theories on the speed of light. And the first of these is that the speed of light will decrease as light travels through a dense medium. And compared to a vacuum, all media are dense. You know, so like water, glass, what have you. And, all right, so that's the speed of light will decrease as it passes through a dense medium. The second theory, this is the one to which I subscribe personally. This one asserts that the speed of light is constant regardless of the medium through which it is traveling. In fact, many physicists who subscribe to the second theory, they still will use the term, the expression, speed of light in a vacuum. Because, you see, it's noncommittal. What I'm trying to say is it has rigorous meanings in both theories. So to elaborate a bit on this, when light passes through a dense medium, it takes longer to arrive at its destination. And this is why a lot of people say that the speed of light is, you know, slowing down. Because, after all, it took longer to get there. It must have slowed down. When my point of view and the point of view of many physicists is not that. It's that the reason it took light a longer time to reach its destination is because its path in which it traveled got elongated. Okay, so what happens is when light travels through a dense medium, it encounters numerous particles, and these particles deflect it. They cause collisions which deflect light off of its geodesic, its path of motion. See, geodesic, this just means it's a path from point A to point B that takes the shortest amount of time among all such paths. So these deflections are what causes light to change its path, and therefore light is traveling in a longer path, and this is why it's reaching its destination later. Right, so this is what accounts for this phenomenon. But to get on to why I feel that this experiment that they performed was flawed, the reason is that due to the quantum behavior of fundamental particles, there is no such thing as a perfect vacuum. Okay, so let me explain that. A fundamental particle is simultaneously everywhere along its wave, as dictated by its wave function. It's a difficult concept to grasp. But this
That's the difficult concept. That's the one?
Definitely is.
That's the one.
It's because we're limited by our experience.
That's why. You know, I'm going to use that as an excuse from now on for my stupidity. I'm limited in my experience. Otherwise, I would know about the quantum
superposition
of a vacuum and the density that moves the light that goes slowly. How are you guys? Before you go on, these are theories, obviously, because if it was true, you'd both know it. You wouldn't. How do you settle this with an arm wrestle or something? The guys who think it slows up, I mean, and you think it doesn't slow up. How do you settle that?
That's immaterial to this. Because no matter which theory you subscribe to, whether the speed of light is really slowing down or whether the speed of light is just taking a longer path, it doesn't matter. The experiment will still be flawed.
Oh, okay.
And that's what I'm getting to. This quantum superposition, the point is it leads to something that's even more interesting, another phenomenon that's called quantum tunneling.
Tunneling.
Mm-hmm.
Quantum tunneling.
In quantum tunneling, a fundamental particle can actually tunnel its way through an impenetrable wall.
Now, wait a second. That means the wall is not impenetrable.
Actually, it doesn't.
It can't go through an impenetrable wall if it's penetrable.
Yes. And the problem is the verbiage.
Oh, okay.
When you say tunnel its way, it really doesn't tunnel its way. What happens is it disappears on one side and reappears on the other.
Oh, like the Star Trek thing?
Kind of, sort of. I mean, it could actually disappear and reappear inside the wall.
Wow.
Yeah.
What would it do inside the wall? Nothing. Does it make a mistake? Is it supposed to go through?
No. It's not a mistake. I mean, there's a probability. You have something called a wave function, which is really a probability distribution. And it's able to tell you the probability of the location of a quantum particle as a particle once you observe it.
Okay.
Before you observe it, the particle is literally everywhere.
Literally everywhere.
Everywhere along its wave, the wave that makes, that corresponds to the particle, yes.
Now you understand, and we haven't talked in a while, but I mean, you understand that when I'm asking you questions, I'm like dead serious.
That's an excellent question.
Yeah, okay.
And the fact that you jumped on the impenetrable wall was excellent too.
Oh, okay, good. Because to me, it just sounds like, you know, I'm you guys call it what you call liquid water. I still can't get over that one. You know?
Yeah.
<no. laughs> But go ahead. We're trying to, and I'm trying to follow this in terms of what happened from what you started talking about. We got this quantum thing that can go through the wall.
That's correct.
That nothing else could go through. And sometimes it gets stuck in the middle of the wall.
It doesn't get stuck there. It just appears.
It's stuck.
But it doesn't have to stay there either.
No, it says, hey, I'm in the middle of the wall. I'm going to stay in the middle of the wall now, and then I'll go to the other wall.
I suppose if he wants to. Yeah. I mean, it really doesn't have much choice.
We have to personify this stuff in order to understand it. I hate to make it sound like a cartoon, but I guess that's the best way I understand it. Here I am talking about
Here's an example of quantum tunneling. Remember how in the 60s we were taught Bohr's model of the atom? That's where we had that there's the atom consisted of a central nucleus.
That picture of the atom. I remember
the electrons revolved around it in shells.
Yeah.
And they couldn't go to different shells unless they had sufficient energy, quantum energy. And, you know, well, actually, the fact of the matter is and they never taught us this, an electron can actually spend a significant amount of time within the nucleus of an atom.
Okay.
And the reason is it can tunnel through the nucleus wall.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah.
Tunnel.
So, you know, they didn't teach us that.
So use the word, using tunnel as a verb, and it's tunneling. Is it me leaving behind a hole?
No, it's kind of like what I said. It's kind of like just disappearing and reappearing.
All right.
Yeah. So to bring everything together, the reason that the experiment is flawed is because quantum particles can tunnel through the wall of a vacuum tube. So the point is, there's no such thing really as a true vacuum. And the minuscule differences that these researchers are getting in their experimental measurements, right? They're encountering measurements. They fall well within the parameters of predictability, as long as you assume that the experiments are not performed in a true vacuum.
So how are they buying it? If you don't buy it, don't they see what you see? Why don't?
No, they don't. That's the point.
Really? I mean, I'm having a problem with that because they think.
Well, they're experimental physicists, so they do experiments and they give the results, and then they, you know, the media, you know, maybe they give a little urging to the media in this direction. I don't know, mm-hmm. But then the media says, "Well, gee, if that's right, then Einstein didn't know what he's talking about." You know, he's in the grave; he can't defend himself.
Now these media, these guys who cover this stuff, they're no. If they were so smart, they wouldn't be covering it; they'd be doing it. So, who are they to suddenly come up with something like to make a statement like that?
You hit the nail on the head right there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's good to know that there's some nail hitting going on with me.
I guess the point is that I believe that Einstein is still very safe. If you remember in a previous show, I was debunking the faster-than-light neutrino.
Yes.
You know, so now I'm debunking this. This is, as far as I'm concerned, any mathematician or experimental any mathematician or theoretical physicist would see through this. This is not like a special gift that I have.
There's a school. That's your school of thought, and there's others in it.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, sure. There'll always be others.
So I guess what I can get by this is that experimental physicists are not on the same. They're not on the same level. They're just kind of perfunctory. Is that it?
Are they? More or less. I mean, they're not. You know, I don't want to put them down. I mean, they're not on the same wavelength.
Well, wavelength. I mean, they're just doing perfunctory things. They're right, and they're not doing
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I suppose I don't want to disagree with that.
Okay.
But the thing is that theoretical physicists are actually working with the mathematics. Okay, mm-hmm. So they're actually able to come up with theories that are solidly, you know, that are firmly grounded in mathematics. Experimental physicists do not do that. They're aware of the theories. Okay, and I think that, you know, what they'd love to do is open a whole new door to physics by showing that some of these results are wrong. But, I'm sure if it hasn't happened already, it won't be very long before there's a ground movement to come out against the results of this experiment.
Well, I guess we're going to see riots.
Faster than light neutrino, if you remember.
We'll see.
No time at all, there were people publishing papers saying the experiment was flawed in that case as well.
And we'll see riots in the streets once there's a groundswell of disagreement in this. But here's a question, though. I mean, experiment. Who are these guys working? Who's? What are they doing? I mean, do they wake up one day? Experimental physicists. I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Do they work for some company that's trying to figure out this particular mathematical problem so that they could make a product or do something or make money? I mean, who are they working for
No. I think mainly they're academicians.
They're what?
Looking for a fast track. You know, this is like, you know, if you're going to get noticed, get exposure and get fame, you know, what you do is you conduct experiments to try and undermine the existing laws of physics.
Do they get grants or something?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. So I'm wondering how they, you know, how they buy lunch if they're just sitting around looking at vacuums.
Yeah.
You know, I just don't understand how these people.
No, it's serious business, you know, but you have to be able. The next example I'm going to give you is another flawed experiment.
Okay.
This is the actual article is from Science World Report. Is new discovery challenges Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, advancing quantum mechanics, and what really you know, I'm going to rant on the advancing quantum mechanics because it should be destroying it, because there is if you undermine the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, there is no quantum mechanics. It's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle is the holy grail of quantum mechanics.
Okay, now for those of us who don't have it, don't know it verbatim, why don't you tell us?
I'm going to tell you first. Good. It's just not easy to define, and that's part of the problem. Actually, I'll give you some descriptions that people use, but the main part of the problem is that the Heisenberg uncertainty principle is really poorly understood.
Well, it's uncertain, I guess.
Okay, so one description, for example, that's used very often, I've seen it. Mm-hmm. If certain properties of a quantum system are measured with precision at a given point in time, then certain other related properties cannot be so measured at that time. Okay, so the properties that you refer to here, or they're called conjugate properties. A common example is position and velocity. Another example is position and momentum. Okay, so people basically say you cannot know or you cannot measure the precise position and velocity of a particle at the same time. And I see this as a problem of language because rather than frame the principle as the notion that you cannot measure or know the position and velocity of a particle at the same time, it's really more correct to say the particle does not have an exact position and velocity at the same time. Yeah. I know that sounds strange, but that's accurate, and that's honest. Okay. For starters, removing this notion of measurement from the statement of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, it prevents people from falling into a common trap, and that is thinking that they can somehow circumvent the principle by simply finding out a more clever way to measure, or by developing a better measurement technology. Okay, it's not that at all. Okay, it's not inferior equipment, it's not inferior technology that's responsible for limitations mm-hmm. that are described in the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. It's nature and mathematics.
Okay.
Like, for example, I'm going to give you a rigorous definition just to make a point. To do so, I'll have to use mathematical terms such as Lie groups, commutators, eigenstates, Fourier transforms.
No problem. Everybody, take out your manuals.
Yeah, I'm not going to elaborate on that, but just this is what it would take if I really wanted to, a good definition, a good and accurate working definition of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, is going to require terms such as that: Lie groups, commutators, eigenstates, and statistical terms such as variance, standard deviation. And the conclusion would actually read as follows. This is the Heisenberg uncertainty principle rigorously, right? The product of the standard deviations of two conjugate observables must be bounded below by 1/2 H cross, where H cross is the reduced Planck constant. So what I'm saying is this is mathematics. It's mathematics and statistical mechanics. And by the way, the reason why the lower bound even comes into play is also mathematics. The reason is because conjugate observables do not share a common time-independent eigenstate. And this is all technical language.
Yeah, and you're telling me.
Yeah, but you see, it's mathematics. It's not.
Yeah, man, it's not. This is not something most people deal with every day, though.
No, but it's also something that's not just the idea of a mad person. It's not something where you want to really say, well, this, you know, let's see how we can disprove this by experimentation.
Right.
I mean, you can try. Let me explain where their experiment went awry. So I actually have an excerpt here for the article, if I can get that up.
Okay.
The downside, here it is, the downside of this type of measurement is that a single measurement only provides a small amount of information. And to get an accurate readout, the process has to be repeated multiple times and the average taken. Right? So what the experimenters are doing, they're conducting multiple runs of the same experiment. They're hoping to infer something about the behavior of a single particle by averaging the behavior of multiple particles. And this is a clever idea, actually, on the face of it, all right? But the problem is this. This paradigm is only valid if one's able to ensure identical experimental conditions for every single run.
Well, even I know that's difficult.
Yes, I knew you would.
Yeah, that I could, wow. Boy, they don't ask in too much of themselves, are they?
But you see, Frank, what it means to have identical experimental conditions, it means it has to also hold at the quantum level. And at this level, it would be, you could translate this to say, every photon that they're measuring must have identical quantum state. And this is where everything breaks down. This is where their experiment breaks down. So, well, there's two ways. Let me separate these. First, there's what I'll call experimental failure one. Okay, this is if they decide that they're going to do a single run and they're going to measure multiple particles during that single run. Okay, then there is something called the Pauli exclusion principle. And this principle says that the particles cannot occupy the same quantum state. So you may throw that away. Experimental failure two is, let's suppose that we're going to measure just one particle, but we're going to do this over several runs. And this time, again, the particles cannot occupy the same quantum state. This is called the no cloning theorem. So what I'm saying is, in summary, this problem with experiment is that this averaging process that's being used to make assumptions about the single particle, it's really assuming uniformity of the light source that they're measuring, the photons. But this assumption fails to address, and it even violates some other basic accepted physical principles. Okay, so if you're going to run your experiment, you have to adhere. You can't say, well, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is wrong, and to prove it, I'm going to assume that other well-established principles are wrong as well. See, that's it. So just as in the case of the light, speed of light, Heisenberg uncertainty principle will survive. Okay? And nature is the reason. Nature is the reason it survives. Yeah, it's nature. So is the exclusion principle. So is the no cloning theorem. These are all natural results. You know, they're coming from nature, but they're being explained via mathematics, some statistics, and some theoretical physics.
In the world of physics, let's face it, this is a unique group of people who through the ages have concentrated on dealing with this stuff. And although so many people out there, the general population is not, doesn't realize how they benefit from all this.
Right.
But there are people doing this stuff. It's just like, you know, it's like you just put this dishwashing stuff, soap, into your sponge, and then you clean. But you know, you never think about the probably billions of pieces of thought. How do you break up thought? Pieces, the billions of thought of all the things it took to find the ingredients and the elements. We take advantage of all this stuff. Maybe it's because it's so gosh darn complicated. I mean, is this where did this stuff? Not to throw off what you're talking about. I'm ready to buy it. I mean, I'm ready to buy the speed of light goes the same. I have no reason to think that it doesn't, and I don't know why that would affect me. Why would that affect me if the speed of light suddenly slowed up through a dense atmosphere? What would that mean to the general population of Earth?
Absolutely nothing.
Nothing. Okay. So these guys, why are these guys trying to figure this out? Are they just out to discredit Einstein and the whole deal and what?
Well, no. I mean, I think you're also talking about Einstein himself and the people who came up with these original theories. It's intellectual inquiry. It's you might add to that equation. For example, the Hadron Collider was $10 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if you're going to be talking about how is this stuff useful to the everyday person, you could even throw that in and say, yeah, and look what it costs. But it's not. I mean, it's just man's thirst to try and discover answers.
But out of this thirst, out of this hunger and thirst, I don't know how you separate the thirst from the hunger in terms of these things. But right. out of that particular desire, let's just call it desire, come many, 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 many things. I don't think a lot of people realize
That's true. That's so very true.
Yeah, I don't think people realize, and I remember like my father and all these people who used to talk about how much money is being wasted on sending men to the moon and shooting up these rockets. What for? What? They had this very simple idea that so we get we shoot the men, they go to the moon, they walk around and they come back and we could say we went to the moon. They think that's the purpose, the only thing that came out of that. But meanwhile, so much has gone on and that is affecting their lives due to how all that stuff was, how people, scientists and everybody learned to miniaturize things and do stuff, right? I mean, so...
Absolutely. You are so on the mark with that statement. If it weren't for the space exploration, we wouldn't have Velcro, for example. If it weren't for the theory of relativity, we wouldn't have accurate GPS systems. The thing is that it takes several years for a physical discovery to work its way down.
Are people you think people are just reticent to change that they don't realize?
I think they don't realize that there actually is a payoff to this, but it's coming unpredictably. It's coming so far into the future. A lot of people want to see research that's dedicated to the here and now. You know, and this is research that goes into a huge storehouse of knowledge that ultimately will, you know, manifest itself in future discoveries. Who knows? Maybe one day a time machine.
I heard a guy talking, a military guy, scientific military guy, talking about how much it costs for one of these smart missiles. Okay, they've created these, you know, those, you've seen those things. They're like, they're computer. I don't know how they operate, but I mean, they deal with the whole digital math. There's a lot of science and math in the fact that they're able to build this. And you know, one of them costs like what, $2-3 million or something? One of them. And now they're talking, they're literally talking about lasers.
Mm-hmm.
So we're sitting around laughing, yet all that laser technology. I think, you know, this is all Alvin Toffler stuff, and I've talked about it a million times. You know what I mean? We just accept that this technology moves along even faster than we think. So one day, you need something in your eye, an eye doctor says, why don't you go for laser surgery? And, you know, it's like, you know, and, you know, you go, what? They have that now.
I know.
And so now they're talking about laser. But listen to this. He said the laser beam, the laser is a weapon. Can do as much damage or what have you, but it costs like $2.50.
Everyone should have one.
So I'm like, wow, you know. So now we're gonna have, I guess, I don't know. Maybe the NRA will expand out and become the NLA too, and National Laser Association. If we're all allowed to have lasers. I mean, I'd like to see them interpret the Constitution from guns to laser. But
absolutely.
So, but what this really says is that things fall by the things that people think are constant are not constant. And to look at this like in a mathematical thought process, we tend, like you're saying, here and now, we like and we're comfortable as a race with constants, and yet things are growing out of things that make other things not useful anymore, and the constant becomes something new, and more times than not, something better.
Yes, and one of the important things to remember is that not all of these improvements are the result of dedicated research. You know, in other words, research that's aimed toward a specific goal.
Accidents, you mean? Then things happen.
Well, some of them are accidents, and some of them are just development of theory. And in theory, and this is really true in pure mathematics, you never understand the consequences of what you're doing until 200 years after you've done it. You know, at least you're not guaranteed of it being any quicker than that.
Mm. Dr. Andrew Waldar is with us as Cotola Chronicles, and we're talking about any number of things that might, you know, write stuff down, people, and then go look it up later. I wish that Dr. Waldar, I wish you had one of those sites like those guys from the what channel is that? Is that the History Channel where they do that universe stuff? And
Discover, maybe? I'm not Discover. Even sure, but yeah. Actually, I have a website. I just don't do anything like that. Time.
I guess, and maybe in time, you know. But I'm thinking that maybe we should think about measuring time differently, too.
We should. That's a good idea.
That's a concept anyway.
We've discussed that.
Yes. I'm still wondering how I can play ping pong on the back of a train, but
yeah, a
moving platform train. But Dr. Waldar is talking about a number of things that that you might be hearing or reading about. And do you read about these things? You don't read about a lot of this stuff in the news, like you talk about the media, how they pick up on things. They did pick up on the planets. I mean, when something big happens like that, it becomes like general news.
These stories I related will become general news.
So
I don't know that there'll be headlines, but I mean, yeah, they'll be in the newspapers.
So, what else are you debunking?
More debunking for now.
No.
What I want to do is get, or at least I'm getting out of my debunk mode, because the Higgs boson is back in the news.
The Higgs boson's back in the news. Now, this is the very famous God particle that they called.
Yes. Which, by the way, I see people, you know, the origin of God particle, you know, it was first meant to be goddamn particle.
Was it really?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because what happens is it was just, you know, causing some grief. It was unexpected.
Mm.
The news media turned it into the God particle, which had to do with creation and, you know, anywhere you want to go with it from there.
Right.
And now some very well-established and famous physicists are riding with it. They're saying, yeah, yes, what God particle means all along, but it's not. So anyway, in this story, what's happened is it's not fully confirmed, at least when I last looked. In fact, the title of one article is that they – let me see if I can raise that. It's kind of funny. 99.6, get this. Scientists say they are 99.6% certain they found Higgs boson. I don't know how you come up with 99.6.
Well, you know, what do you expect from scientists? They're not going to go, a little bit of this. You're not going to say,
That's true. That's true.
They're going to come up with something. Yeah.
But they're using some measure for that. But you see, a lot of this is interesting because it seems that in some camps, people believe that they should hold up on giving Higgs the Nobel Prize in Physics until they're sure that it's the boson that he predicted. So this is interesting. You remember I was on the show actually, and I talked about how the Higgs field and the Higgs boson came into existence as far as a theory. So let me recall that briefly, right? So we're going back to the 60s, and at that point in time, the standard model of particle physics was deemed incomplete. And this is because its underlying mathematical machinery failed to adequately predict mass. And Higgs well understood this. So he envisioned how the problem could be rectified. He envisioned that if he extended the standard model by inputting a new field, okay, that's nowadays called the Higgs field, then all of a sudden the mathematical machinery would spit out the mass of the known particles. Now, at this initial stage, Higgs didn't realize that adding this new field to the standard model would predict the existence of a new particle. That's only after the mathematics was worked out. And after that, all of a sudden, the machinery spits out this single new mystery particle that was not accounted for in the standard model. So this is where it's actually coming from. And the math machine, by the way, it also asserted that this new particle had to be a boson, which a boson is it's a fundamental particle with integer spin, 0, 1, 2, 3. And also it's a force mediator. Okay, the integral spins make particles force mediators. So what happens is in this article I was reading, which is it appeared in Christian Science Monitor, that's the one that says, scientists say they're 99.6% certain they found the Higgs boson. And the byline of the article is, after thousands of checks, Italian scientists said the only remaining thing they need to check is that the Higgs-like particle they found last July isn't another subatomic particle called a graviton. And the graviton is also a boson. And this is, it's at once amazing and puzzling. The graviton is the boson that mediates the force of gravity. Okay, except for one thing. Gravity is not even built into the standard model of particle physics. Okay, and another difference is the boson, it has to have integer spin. The graviton has spin too. Okay, the Higgs boson, we'll call it, the mystery particle, it's spin zero. Here's another thing, though. The Higgs boson has relatively large mass, as bosons go.
And the graviton... wait. Yeah. I know, just sometimes you say things and I fly out. My bosons get over, they knock against one another. Say that again. Is relatively, as far as bosons go.
Bosons go. It has relatively large mass.
So there's smaller bosons.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of bosons.
The graviton, okay, in particular, it's a virtual particle. It's hypothesized particle. It has mass zero. If in fact it exists, it has mass zero.
I like that one. Now, after all this, if in fact it exists. Right. I love that. I love, it's like, now if we're real right about, is that because this is supposedly so small, we can't possibly identify it, see it in any way?
Yes. Most of this stuff is. I mean, this happens, you know, it exists because of its predicted interaction with other particles that you can see.
This is the problem with quantum, which of course is the smallest, means the smallest.
Or black holes, for example.
Yeah.
You know they exist because you see the gravitational effects on other parts of, you know, for example, in a binary star system, very often you have a living star with a black hole.
Yeah.
And they're spinning around, and you say to yourself, well, there's no way that a star can spin around like that unless there's a gravitational force.
That's what I say to myself. Yeah.
But you see, what I really find interesting about this, as I say, gravity is not built into the standard model. So in my opinion, if this new particle were to be identified as a graviton, it would be a much more incredible result than the Higgs boson. Because the reason is now physicists would have to rethink the standard model in such a way that they incorporate gravity into it. And this could be the first step in reaching a unified field theory. This is what, the four fields, the electromagnetic, the weak nuclear, the strong nuclear, and gravity. Unified field theory is the problem that plagued Einstein for his entire life. You know, so I don't know. I feel that they should definitely confer upon Biggs this Nobel Prize of Physics immediately, you know, regardless of what happens.
Because if nothing else, he's certainly launched all of this this entire area that was never addressed, correct?
Right, right.
That alone, while, is that's a big thing alone, isn't it?
That's a very big thing. And while I'm at it, I'm going to give kudos to the experimental physicists in this in their role, because they had to be extremely clever to cook up experiments to actually be able to identify.
Right, because there's nothing there. It's a whole new new field.
Yeah, exactly.
As far as bosons go, at least.
Now, before I leave the Higgs boson, I want to clear up the fact that there's not a, you shouldn't say, no one should say the Higgs boson, because the Higgs bosons are actually a family of bosons.
That's why they're the Higgs family.
Yeah. Right,
the Higgs family bosons. As far as bosons go.
As far as bosons go. Yes.
So what do we do with the Higgs? How's that? That's back in the news that way. And what are we going to find out about that per se?
I don't know. If they're 99.6% of the way there, it's probably imminent.
Are we going to talk about the collider? I mean, are they any close to finding the bang or doing the bang or recreating the bang or what?
Yeah. You know, I wasn't really prepared to talk about, well, not prepared to talk about anything really, but.
Well, welcome to the club.
Yeah, really. No, you taught me that, you know, sure,
right.
Not a program.
Never rehearse. Right. Okay.
But the Hadron Collider, you know, the main reason, it does several things. It's involved with a lot of things, but the main reason it was created in the first place, funded and created, was because it is supposed to. It's the best attempt to simulate the Big Bang.
Mm-hmm. And we have to assume there was a Big Bang. We're not assuming this anymore, correct?
That's a theory. It's a theory.
We're still assuming that?
Everything's a theory. Everything's a theory in physics. It gets stronger each time you refute it by experiment and the experiment fails. Or each time you conduct an experiment, the experiment supports.
That's because,
the theory gets greater. But it's not like mathematics. Mathematics is different.
Okay.
Theory in mathematics is based on axioms. And what happens is you can decide once and for all whether a theory is right or wrong based on axioms.
Right. So, but if they recreate this, does that make it no longer a theory?
I don't think it does, and that's because there's something that just has to do with Planck. Remember, earlier I mentioned the reduced Planck constant.
Yeah,
yeah. This is another thing that's really very fundamental in the universe. It basically discretizes the universe. It's the smallest. Depending on whether you talk about Planck time or Planck distance, you know, Planck length. This is like, it's infinitesimally small. In fact, according to string theory, it's the size of a string. And it's basically impossible. It's indivisible, truly indivisible, in the sense that this is why I talked earlier about the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Okay, you can never be quite sure of the exact, if you have two conjugate observables. You can't be sure of measuring each of them accurately. That's because of Planck's reduced constant.
Yes,
so the point is that there is a moment in time right after the Big Bang, or initially starting with the Big Bang, because you see the Big Bang starts time running too. There's no such thing as time before the Big Bang. It's ill-posed. A lot of people say, well, what happened before the Big Bang? It's an ill-posed question, what happened before it, because time started with it. But my point really is that there's this infinitesimal amount of time, Planck time, that no one will ever be able to see. Mm. Okay, so I guess in that sense, you always have to regard it as a theory.
I think that something just dawned on me that I never thought about before in this exact way. Scientists, well, everything we're talking about here now and the difference between theory and fact, I guess if fact is the opposite of theory or whatever, is that there must be some proof and that you do the experiments and it furthers the possibility that the theory is fact. Am I right in following?
That's 100% right, you are.
Okay, so then the confrontation between that and people who have fixed beliefs is the fact that, let me just say this, people who are really like Bible written. I mean, they use anything. I mean, not just necessarily the Bible. Let's say they got some kind of document that they adhere their lives and their beliefs.
Faith.
Huh?
Faith.
No, I don't know. I guess it requires faith, but they do believe. They believe this is the way. They don't say, they don't come up to you like a scientist and say, well, you know, we haven't really done much experiments about Moses and walking through the desert. You see what I'm saying? They just say, this is the way it happened, period.
It's a blind adherence.
Yeah. And
no, I in no way put down any people who are like that.
But you see what I'm saying? I mean, I hadn't thought about this before. The fact that scientists, if we want to call them scientists or mathematicians, are always exploring the possibilities of things and that they might believe in, but they're not saying, well, you know, I buy that because look, you're arguing, two guys arguing about the speed of light through a vacuum, and you're going to have, but you're not going to get two guys, no matter how they interpret like something biblical or Quranical. Is there such a word as Quranical? About the Quran?
Yeah, I don't know.
No, whatever, you know, they're not going to argue that because they already have a sense of this happened, so now this.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that that particular difference between thoughts, people in this world, humans, that's people in this world, humans, is, it can't last, can it? The more you prove things that dismiss other things, the more important it is for everybody to go along with it. Am I making sense here?
You're making sense, but I don't quite agree because, you see, there are two different paths, you know. So, I mean, there are, in order to believe in religious doctrine, you have to have a certain amount of faith. And I guess the same thing's true with physics. It's just one of those things that no one can exactly prove 100% or disprove 100%. And a lot of scientists have faith. They have faith in religion, you know, and it's just a different, you know, it's on a different wavelength, the two modes of thought. So someone can be very scientific minded, can understand the whole idea of, you know, scientific reasoning. What constitutes a proof, what constitutes a conjecture, and still those same people operating on this different wavelength can still have faith.
Faith
is kind of an adherence to a belief
in
the absence of what a scientist would call sufficient information.
Yes, I'm saying, yeah, can you understand what I'm saying? And I know you can.
I think I can. But I don't think it's ever going to come around.
No?
The entire scientific process, I don't think, is ever going to escalate. You know, it's not a question. As they say, scientists have faith as well in religious doctrine. So I don't think it's the kind of thing where one is going to have an adverse effect on another. I really don't.
I'd like to. I wish I could get a gigantic grant and be able to write and to be able to look into this. This would be my great study, friends and comrades. And that would be how do these two schools meet? And somewhere along the way, they don't have to, obviously, but they're just so far apart that it doesn't seem to help anyone. Regardless of which side you're on, I guess. I don't know.
Right.
I just, when you keep telling me these things, you know, and I keep understanding, when I understand the fact that, you know, but we know there's bosons, and we know there's things, quantums we can't see, but we know because of effects and stuff like that. To be that intricate, and to actually, look beyond what any human said, because look, the people even saying Einstein, okay, you got this theory, it's all well, the theory of relativity, it's all fine, and this stuff comes into play, but we're still going to question that, and this and that, and this and that.
Well, yeah, of course.
You know, and yet, this the faith thing, almost, it doesn't almost, it disallows for the investigation.
Yeah, it just allows for scientific investigation. Absolutely.
So, so it seems that the same people. It seems that well, of course, there are people who won't. There are people with. And I don't mean to turn this into a versus. It's just that this always drives me nuts. And when we talk, it always drives me nuts because I just don't understand the ability to grasp. Something that someone just says. I mean, I guess I'm more, in a sense, I'm more of a scientist because I'm not like your kind of scientist, for God's sake.
I understand because you want to see facts, you want to analyze them.
Yeah, and I'm always looking into why this, why that, who that, what did, what, where, when, why. No one could just come up to me. Even you, I ask you questions, and you're like a trillion times smarter than I am in that respect. And yet I'm going like, okay, right. So can a boson, does a boson have? How do we know a boson doesn't have arms? You know, it's like
right, exactly.
Yeah. So this becomes more and more fascinating to me. But then again, I don't even understand how Buckminster Fuller looked up one day and went, we can actually have a roof without any posts. This guy, to me, that's like amazing. It's like, wow, this guy's great. I would have loved to have been in the room. You're kidding. No. We'll just make it geodesic. And they're like, wow, we don't even know that word. This is terrific. And then he does it. That's fascinating. And before that, there were, let's face it, just like there were people saying, Christopher Columbus, you better not go, and you're going to fall off the earth. It's like, wow, is that stupid? It's like, and then those things are disproven on very large scales, of course, but then. So this always fascinates me at levels that are different, not different, they're more generic, I guess, than the intricates that you go into. And I learn a lot, so I appreciate it. This is Dr. Waldar. I know I wouldn't last a week in his class because I you would be like, you, out, that's it,
I don't think so, but
listening and understanding and trying to get anywhere near a general understanding of this stuff so fascinates because it is the way I think. Well, I just can't think at that level of academic level.
Well, we're actually going to turn now into something that I'm sure you're much more familiar with.
Okay.
Which is evolution. And I have a soundbite too. This article which says primate call gives clues to human speech origins.
Whoa.
Yes, and I do have a soundbite of that. I'll get to in a second. So, and I hope that it'll play so you can hear it. Scientists have found that the Galata, G-E-L-A-D-A, a species, Galata,
okay.
A species that is closely related to the baboon, makes a gurgling noise that shares features with human language.
Whoa, I love this.
Yes, I know.
Yeah.
I mean, this is like the missing link of linguistics, so... Because the sounds that the great apes make and the sounds humans make, and they never really found something that could have been, the type of sound that the early humans might have made. And I'm talking like 30 million years ago. So the study is published in Kern Biology, and the lead author is from the University of Michigan, and he says, Galatas make vocalizations that have some speech-like properties. And it's the first time that has been shown in a non-human primate. So let me bring that up for us.
Yeah, bring that up.
Hey, let's see.
I'm going to hear these guys. The Galatas. They're Italian?
They're Italian, yeah.
The Galatas. The Galata family, the baboons were out there.
That sounds like the Mafia family.
Yeah, I know. The Galatas.
Okay, here we go. Let me know if you can hear it. Can you hear it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, where, how are they getting these sounds? Oh, I love that.
How are they?
Where'd you get these? Where'd you get these little samples?
Oh, yeah. This is the link that I had is the BBC. Mm-hmm. for anyone who's interested, it's got a long URL, but it's bbc.co.uk /news/science, or is that a forward slash? Never mind.
Yeah.
science-environment-22067192.
Okay.
But, you know, I think anyone can go on YouTube. Mine did not come from YouTube, but I've seen similar things. If they look up Gelada, G-E-L-A-D-A, they can not only D. Hmm?
G-E-L.
G-E-L-A.
A-D-A.
Yep. Yeah. And they will not only hear these noises that Gelada makes, but they'll be able to see a bunch of Geladas jumping around.
Can you play the Gelada? Can play the Gelada again?
Absolutely.
Yeah, let's hear the Gelada again.
Yeah, let me see where it is. Yeah, well, maybe I have to. Did I close it?
I don't know.
It'll only take a second to.
Get the Gelada back up here.
Get the Gelada.
I got a feeling I thought I knew what he was talking about.
Okay, ready?
Yeah, go. Here's the Gelada. Okay.
And it's over.
That remarkably resembles my father and my uncle's talking after Thanksgiving dinner. It's amazing.
Now I'm laughing because you're so right what you said earlier about uncles.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You're taking up sports.
That's what you hear in your head after a while, because you know they're going to come up with something stupid, and you hear that's what you hear is the God is.
It sounds like an uncle.
Yeah, there goes Uncle Vito again. Well, that's incredible. Where are these baboon like creatures?
Right.
Are actually saying things to each other, like one of them's probably saying, "Go throw out the garbage" or whatever.
Yeah, right? All the great apes are communicating to one another, but this is. This type of garbling is actually, sounds to me to be so, but I'm taking more than that. I'm relying on the advice of experts that it is mimicking human, it's showing early human speech patterns.
Do we know where human speech began to develop? I mean, I don't, obviously. I mean, asking. Do we know where?
I have no, this is not in my realm. I can't speak with any authority on this.
Yeah, remember the caveman movies when they made up all that language? You know, there was one movie, I think it was actually 1 million BC. It was the one with the...
Oh, yeah, Raquel Welch.
Yeah, yeah. Imagine a cave woman like that hanging around.
I don't think we paid attention to much of what was going on in that movie.
But I think they said it was either that one or it was that other stupid one with Shelley Long and Ringo Starr.
Oh, my God.
Remember? Oh, no, I know what it was. Wait a second. I know what I'm talking about. There is one with Daryl Hannah, Cave. It's after a book, Cave of the... Oh, wow.
Clanbearer?
Huh?
Cave of the Clanbearer.
Yeah. Hey, now I sound like a Gelada. Yeah. That's exactly where the Italians got it, too. When they went, they can say yeah once. I'd say a thousand times. Now, they say that in that book, or with the book, the movie, that they literally created a language with different sounds that meant different things so that the actors could relate to one another. Although maybe that came from the book. I don't know. But I remember that. I also I don't remember following it too well because I was more into Daryl Hannah than Reckle Welch, to be honest with you.
Yes, okay. I can believe that.
Yeah, but you see what I'm saying? The language must have developed from the same way that, there's an evolution to it, right? The same.
Exactly. I mean, it's hard. It's really hard to pinpoint how do you pinpoint that? The thing is that this seems to be the first evidence of something that is in between.
Yeah.
What was thought to be the most elevated level of speech in an ape. and the earliest indication of what was known as man speech. This is actually somewhere in between them. It really is like a linguistical missing link.
How much of Joseph Campbell stuff have you read? A lot?
Including today?
Today? You read some today? Also? Today?
Including today?
Yeah.
None.
Oh, really? Okay. I guess maybe it's just popular with writers or what have you. If you get a chance, look them up on YouTube and look at some of the stuff. Because his, I don't even know how to describe Joseph Campbell. I don't want to get into it anyway, but it reminds me of, it's just how these things, how the drama of life and, you know, he talks about Star Wars as, you know, it's the same thing as a story, the same elements as a story told from people who didn't even have their this language.
Right.
You know, that the same dynamics took place in, and he goes back to all these religious, tribal and religious and various stories about creation and gods and stuff. And they find the same properties, the same elements of drama in all of them, no matter the language.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're translated, they're all Star Wars. But I mean, Star Wars is just a perfect example. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
So the language, language must have developed in evolution and evolved the same way, and it must have also had similar. It must have had similar meanings. I don't really understand myself how somehow a source of people called what I'm holding in my hand, this writing utensil, a pen, and yet the French go, pen, what's that? It's a plume, les plumes. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. I mean, why is it a plume to you and a pen to me? It's a plume to, you know, why is it, how that meaning, the same exact thing, takes on a whole different sound in terms of communication is fascinating, which means that, to me, that means that it evolved, the language evolved in a whole bunch of different ways all over the place.
Oh, no question. No question. And all this evolution of language had to do, this is what Dr. Popoli could tell you, it had to do with development of the prefrontal cortex of the brain. Because, you know, that's the area that's associated with social activity. You know, it makes someone want to be social.
So when we hear the Galata, we're not necessarily referring to English.
No.
We're just referring to communication by use of something we call a word, which is something we say.
Right. It's more sound. Yes. It's more that we're referring to the manner in which vocalization can take place. Various changes in lip smacking and various changes in the tongue curling and stuff like that.
Now, I don't know why that didn't make big news. That's a great headline. That's incredible.
I think it's wonderful. I really like that. How about this one?
Go.
Did you know that dinosaurs could swim? This is coming out of Edmonton Journal.
Now, when you know all dinosaurs, I mean, just in general, dinosaurs, cause, like dogs?
They were tyrannosaurs. They were from the family Tyrannosaurus, of which the Tyrannosaurus is one.
So, tyrannosaurs could swim even with hardly any arms?
Yeah, it wasn't a question. In fact, here's the title. It'll answer some of what you're asking. Dinosaurs did their own version of the dog paddle. University of Alberta researcher says. And the new evidence is coming from track marks at the bottom of the Chinese riverbed. And it suggests that dinosaurs had been able to swim long distances.
Okay, but what is that? Wait a second, though. How does that affect our understanding of their size? I mean, a riverbed. How would swim in a river? If you're that gigantic, it's got to be a pretty deep, dense. That'd be a dense body of water.
Well, absolutely. Well, not all tyrannosaurs are as large as tyrannosaurs.
Okay, you meant okay. Yeah, those raptors. Did they make up raptors? Or they really are? Yeah. They really were.
That's Jurassic Park. No, yeah. The raptors existed.
Except a lot of them, it was just discovered also. Not discovered, but it was just revealed that a lot of those in the scene with the kids in that kitchen with the raptors.
Yeah, remember that, right?
It was just revealed that a lot of that were men in suits.
Wow.
Yeah, it was not CGI.
That was really convincing.
Yeah, man. Because that would make a Galata. That would a Galata tell the other Galata.
So you mean to say that was a guy in a suit who took that? You remember the one of them smashed full speed into the reflection of the kids.
I can't testify that exact one was that guy, but it was not CGI that whole scene. And they actually showed somewhere. You can look this up somewhere too on the net now. Because they're talking about how they did a lot of that. And I always wondered about that. I went, geez, how advanced could there were actually mechanical dinosaurs and everything. And mechanical, and it's just, and it has not been, it does not have to be proven that mechanical dinosaurs cannot swim. Unless they could hardly get that Jaws thing going when they
That's
did
right.
big rubber. Did you ever go to, I remember when I was living out in L.A. and I don't know, I think someone came and said, all right, I'll go to the Universal tour. Yeah, I never went, you know. And there was that big rubber stupid, you know, Jaws.
Yeah.
You know, and the big, and they had a King Kong. You know, they had a King Kong exhibit when I was there. And they had, I kid you not, as Jack Paul would say, I kid you not, that King Kong came up, and he's this big mechanical thing, of course, and he would roar, and they actually had the smell of bananas on his breath. It was fascinating. And I said to myself, you can't tell me if there was a gorilla this big that his breath smelled like bananas. But I stray. That is fascinating, though, the more stuff about the dinosaurs, which never show up in the Bible.
Well, here's no something dinosaurs. I love to get this one sentence from the article. It cracks me up. The dinosaur's claw marks show it was swimming along in the river, and just the tippy toes were touching the bottom.
So there, they didn't talk about how dense it might have been. Yeah, his tippy toes.
Yeah, I can't imagine Tyrannosaur having tippy toes. You know, so. But
well, they never found a drowned Tyrannosaur, so right? They always find the bones and the remains in.
Oh no! But when they find the riverbed is no longer a river.
Yeah.
You know, so even if it had drowned, it would have decayed, you know, the bones and everything.
Foolish of me.
It would never have...
See, that's why. See how you think that way. There's another big difference between us. Cthulhu Chronicles right here. Dr. Andrew Waldar, again, giving us more information than we possibly can fit into one show. And, of course, he'll be back. We're not completely done yet. But Dr. Waldar will be back with more stuff. Let's catch up. Do you want to go to the planets now?
No, I'm not even going to go to the planets.
We're not going to the planets.
What I decided to do is we'll do that on a future show because I want Skylar Hall to join us for the planets.
Sky for the, yes.
Astrophysicist Skylar Hall, yes, and we'll do that show together.
Yeah, let's do that show together. I kept telling Sky that if he could find a music bed, a karaoke version of Adele's Skyfall, the movie theme with the Academy Award winning song.
Right.
If he could find that, we could change the lyrics and I would sing Sky Hall. He would do Sky Hall. I thought this would be great for his show. But here's Sky Hall. I would actually write the lyrics as those. We'll have Skylar on that for that. Yes. Yeah, okay. So we'll talk about, and we may know more about the planets by then too.
Yes. Hopefully we will.
I'm sure Sky is reading up on it right now. The only other Sky I ever knew was Sky Masterson. No, there were two other Skys I knew in literature. Sky Masterson.
The Sky King.
And Sky King, yeah. Remember Sky Masterson from Guys and Dolls? That was the Marlon Brando
in
the movie with Sky Masterson. And, yes, Sky King.
Yes. The cowboy, actually. He was a cowboy with an airplane.
Cowboy with an airplane, that's right.
Yeah.
So, okay, well, are we going to do a last topic? What's our last 10 minutes?
This one is also evolution. It's the role of suicide in evolution.
Whoa!
Yes.
Look
yes.
out. How the heck does that come about?
Well, you see, this is, first of all, I guess the title of the article is Why Bacteria Commit Suicide.
Bacteria. So,
the first thing I got to do is kind of like bring up some points. And I was really kind of foaming at the mouth to do that a few weeks ago when you had your evolution show, that what happens is that a mistake, kind of a slight misconception, not everyone makes it, of course, but some people do, is the natural selection is based on survival of a species. It's not based on the survival of individual members of a species. Okay, so in other words, evolution actually runs counter to the so-called will to survive. Okay, see what I mean by that?
Gotcha!
Okay, so when we talk about suicide, we're not talking about any cognitive process, right? This is not a cognitive decision. We're talking about instinctual behavior. In other words, this idea of suicide is wired into the DNA. So let's see what we have here on this. The smallest example of mass suicide by members of the species for the sake of preserving the species as a whole. And what scientists did is they compared two strains of E. coli bacteria, and one that self-destructs when infected with a lethal virus and one that doesn't. And they found that the infected bacterium not only dies, but also serves as an incubator for some 300 new virus particles, unless it kills itself first.
Unless it kills itself first.
Yeah. And that's the whole idea behind it. It's programmed. This is suicide that's programmed in order to have the species survive, the species being the E. coli bacteria.
And because nothing else ever did this, we use the word suicide. Because it kills itself. It does. That's all it means anyway, right?
Yeah, it self-destructs.
Yeah, it doesn't. There's never a motive. It self-destructs. Yeah. Well, it does it itself. No, it has to do it itself. It has to provoke.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, okay.
There's no thought process involved, though. So it's all instinctual behavior. You see, one way I like to compare the two, the difference, because I think instinctual behavior is actually a very profound form of knowledge. So the way I contrast them is that I feel that instinctual behavior is knowing, and cognition is knowing that you're knowing.
Oh, okay. I'll buy that.
And that's basically, to me, the major difference. Yeah. And you see in many animals who perform instinctually that they are able to solve a lot of problems. Some of them, they're even mathematical. They discovered that ants, for example, have an instinctual response which allows them to travel in geodesics. Remember the thing I raised earlier? Because geodesics are not straight lines. Okay. So, in fact, cognition, higher order cognitive thought, is actually what's caused us. Cognitive thought is kind of redundant. Let's say higher order cognitive function. That's actually what's caused us to branch away from the normal course of natural selection. Mm. So, and in fact, when you talk about evolution, you have to talk about not just natural selection, but also artificial selection, which means selective breeding. And the point is that artificial selection is the type of evolution that operates in the realm of higher cognitive function. For example, agricultural hybrid, for example, take like a seedless orange, for example. Mm-hmm. See, nature did not select oranges to be seedless. We did.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the seedless orange is not the result of natural selection. And this is where higher cognitive function gets involved, and it actually diverges from nature.
Oh, it's funny that we're talking about Jurassic Park, because that's actually built into the story, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Mm, yeah, okay.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, nature.
Yeah, some of Jeff Goldblum's memorable lines. About nature finding a way. And life. By the way, he played a mathematician.
Yes, life will find a way. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, he was a chaos theorist. So, I like mathematicians are now getting more promotion as far as, they're getting more visibility in movie roles and everything like that. So that's really cool.
So bacteria commit suicide.
Right, this one strain of E. coli will commit suicide. E. coli, excuse me, will commit suicide because if it doesn't, it will die anyway, and then some new virus cells will form in it and use it as an incubator.
So built, all right. So built into it is it has to destroy itself in order for its species to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
You got that one right in the head.
Oh, wow. That's and they discovered this when? When did they figure this one out?
This is recent, actually. Let me see if I can get a date up in that. It was in a March 19th of this year article. Yeah.
Yeah, wow. That's
the whole idea. You know, the whole idea of natural selection, you know, doing its job for survival of the species, and cognitive thought is doing its job for survival of independent, you know, individual members of the species.
I thought that was when I first heard the word E. coli, I thought that was a digital disease. That was something new. I found this digital disease.
I don't know how.
E. coli. You get it from? Can you get it from email or what?
Right, exactly.
E's or I's, yeah. Well, that's fascinating. Yeah. That almost is. That's like a. No, forget it. I don't even want to go to what I was thinking. That was just stupid. Okay, so there's another evolution thing. There's another thing that that we're never going to hear about from faith people.
Yeah, if people, there are people that adhere to, you know, the creativity as creation, I should say, as being the science of, you know, I mean, everyone is entitled to his or her opinion. And I don't knock it at all. I think that creation is a theory, and I think that evolution is a theory. And you subscribe to whatever you want. As a scientist, certainly must say that evolution is an excellent theory.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it holds more water than creation. But then again, creation is operating, as I said before, on this different wavelength of faith.
But, yeah, we don't want to go there because that's so much.
Well, there's no point in really going there. You know,
there's no point. I mean, it's
good to have faith. It's good to have faith. I have a good amount of faith myself.
Well, yeah, but you know, we can do another show on this altogether. But the definition of faith as is how it's defined, like in Eastern.
Oh yeah.
As opposed to Western, Judeo-Christian faith is. Just believe it and shut up. Maybe not.
Well, actually, interestingly, and Judeo-Christian, actually Judaism has a different point of view from Christianity in that regard. And that is that in Christianity is more of a religion of pure faith. But in Judaism, you're actually encouraged to ask questions and to doubt.
Yes.
And to read the Talmud, you know, and come up with your own point of views. And there are countless number of accounts and texts about two Jewish rabbis having arguments over this, what means this, what means that, and so on and so forth. So it's really more, you know, it's I suppose that faith still has to come into the picture when it comes to belief in God. But as I say, like, for example, I do believe in God. But I don't believe in any of organized religion's depictions of God. You know, and there's a difference there. But you see, that I feel that I have faith.
Well, the definition of faith and the meaning of life comes down to, you know, as Eastern, I don't even want to use the word religion, but as philosophy. Eastern belief, as Eastern philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Danes, it doesn't have anything to do with the stress of a future place to go. And
right,
and,
that's right.
That's stress. There's a lot of stress in that. You know? But anyway, so as we wind up this, what have we learned here today from Dr. Waldo? Well, we learned that bacteria can commit suicide, if only to keep the rest of the. So like, kind of look at it like a heroic.
Heroic. It certainly becomes more heroic if they have cognitive function, so that is an active decision.
Yes, because it knows the rest. What's more, it knows that the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
Yes.
We learned about the Goliath. The Galata family. The original mob, bamboo mob. I'd love to go out with that sound.
You really do a great impersonation.
Thank you. Well, because I'm a Galata at heart. We all know that.
You want that sound bite for in the future, like first half hours of the show. Yes. I'll send you the sound bite.
Yes, get me the sound bite. And Dr. Woldart, and then we did all the stuff about in the beginning about gravitons, bosons, and the speed of light. The next time you turn, next time you flick a switch and light goes on, time it. Just see who, see what side you're on. Do you think it's slowed up? And what's the difference between slowing up and slowing down? We want to know that, don't
That's
we?
That's a wonderful question.
We want to know that. And you're going back to Dr. Woldart. Give me your website anyway.
Well, what you do, I don't even know.
What you do is you go to
Google and you type in Woldart, and you'll see one of the first links to come up will be my website.
And you have that, and it's just, it can't, if you want to believe in anything predestined or weird connections, you've got to subscribe to the fact that on a level of science fiction, the name Woldart certainly fits into the Flash Gordon lexicon.
Doesn't it?
Yes. Zarkov is nothing. Zarkov has nothing over Woldart.
Nothing.
Which is the name of my new book. And that'll be out next. Thanks again. We do have to run you.
You're very welcome, Frank.
So much appreciation I have for you being here and spending this time with us. And you will be back again next time. Planets and Skylar Hall will join both of us. And you stay well, and let's stay in touch anyway, okay, Doc?
Yes, absolutely.
You're the man.
You are too.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye, Frank.
Dr. Andrew Woldart, Professor. Doctor, I take notes. You know, I don't have a guitar. I have my own notebooks right here. I took notes. Did you take notes with your Cthulhu Chronicles or anything? I did I don't do ums. I was going to say this. Next week, discussions on humor, jokes, and you're going to learn a lot and laugh a lot. A Savino Cthulhu Chronicles live here. Next week, as long as nothing goes wrong between both of us. The old team, once again, as we said, since Tom came back for a reunion, once a month, a Savino Cthulhu Chronicles right here live for everyone. And don't forget to cthulhuchronicles.blogspot.com, where you can get any number of shows. What? What is all the? Oh, you'll find out what's happening when it's happening, and you hit that thing and whatever. We don't use that for a lot of funny stuff anymore. But you'll know what's on the show and everything. And as you're on Facebook, well, you could join me at Facebook, and we can do that there too. And
that's some control over there. You know what I mean?
And we hope to be back because, if the bisons and the bosons and the gravitons and the neurons and all that continue to coagulate in their mathematical behavior, then all of this will work again the next time we go on the air. It goes so quickly. Why? Because it's always something you need to think about. Luck, smarts, guts, and hearts. Remaining Curious Yellow with me, Philosophical Entertainment, Relevant Irreverence. So Netarati, Couple Surface, Netaholics, and Infomaniacs, go back to what you were doing, which is probably the same thing somewhere on your net. You're probably multitasking. Now, whatever you're doing it okay. And those of you people on your iPhones, we'll see you. Look, just go about your business. And stay healthy above all. And me and Uncle Sean will be back along with Tom Savino next week. Good night, Mrs. Ernstweil, wherever you are. Everybody go buy the books. License a Skill at Amazon. Molotov Memoirs at blurb.com. I guess that's about it. I have nothing more to say.